Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today, we're going to dive back into The Eradicator by Mike Smith, 2024 novel. We're going to do chapters 11 and 12, pages 90 to 106. Let's get right to it. Chapter 11, Our Moral Principles. Chapter 11 of The Eradicator, Our Moral Principles. Jake found Greta's meds in the morning. She had left the barn to talk with Martha. Jake studied the pill bottle's label with care. Unfortunately, wear and tear had effaced the medication name. The recommended dosage and the name of the prescribing MD remained. He kept the bottle and its contents. Keeping it would help him to wean her off the stuff. Maybe that would make a difference in her mental state. Waiting for her to return, he took a shower, then got their things together for departure. She had showered before he got up. He tidied the bathroom as best he could. He wondered what breakfast the Groats had for them. He heard a shout. It was Greta. He thought she was having a fit. He went to the door to find out what was going on. He opened the door and Greta was there and fell on him. Jake! Groat appeared in the doorway now. Jake noticed that Greta was bleeding from behind the right ear. Neither of you move. Groat's voice was cold. He had a gun and kept it aimed at the two. What is this? Jake said. He asked Greta, did he hurt you? But she was dumb with fear. Groat said, I called the police. I don't know what they want you for. She didn't say. But she scared Martha half to death, and when I held her for arrest, she hit me in the stomach and ran. Arrest her for what? Jake said. For your being a fugitive, Jake McAllister, Groat replied. Jake realized what had happened. Greta had let his secret slip, telling it to Martha. Groat probably overheard her and didn't want a fugitive from the law on his property. You don't need the police. I'm no criminal, Jake said. I can explain. Put down the gun. Groat shook his head. No. Anyone the government wants must take responsibility and face up to it. I must do my duty. Thinking quickly, Jake asked, Who did you say I am? Jake McAllister. Never heard of him. See, he half whispered, she makes things up sometimes. She's mentally disabled. This person is probably a character in her fantasy world. Makes no difference, Groat said. The state will determine guilt or innocence. It decides what is true or false, since it's the God principle. Groat's eyes held a spark of madness. It is the will of the transcendent made manifest in the material world. The state. Jake said slowly, I see, that makes sense. Groat waved the gun. Sit over there, Jake asked. Where? Groat waved the gun again. I said, over there. Jake grabbed Groat's gun arm. Groat stepped back to re-aim. Jake headbutted him in the face. Time slowed down. Jake had Groat on the floor. Groat grabbed Jake's neck. Jake found a way to knee Groat's stomach repeatedly and did. Now Groat was on top of him, now below. A scratch went across Jake's face. Jake thumbed Groat's cheek, left eye. Groat pushed him off. Jake had the gun now. It was insecure in his numb hands. He pointed it at Groat. Both of Groat's meaty hands went for it. Jake fired and fell on his backside. Groat crumpled forward, his forehead coming to rest on Jake's knees. He was dead, and Jake felt pain, but the pain was only physical. We have to get out of here, he heard himself saying. He got up and took Greta's cold hand. Got everything? Yes. Greta's voice sounded hollow. Wait. Jake searched Groat's pockets and found the car keys. He threw open the apartment door. They would have to climb down the stairs to reach the ground. In the distance, sirens sounded like faraway thunder. He put his arm out, blocking the door. Wait a minute. His mind, that superlative brain, was working, but not working on a scientific problem. Stay here. Now Greta sounded terrified. You're going to leave me. I won't leave you, he cut off. I'm going to get Martha and explain. She looked like a frightened little girl and said nothing. Stay here, Jake repeated and left for the house. He still had the gun. Greta sank to the couch and she cried. She didn't know what to think, but she knew she didn't want the cops to arrest her again. After a few minutes, she heard a car horn honking and froze. She heard it a second time. She had to look and went to the door and saw Jake leaning out of the driver's side window of an unfamiliar sedan. He was honking the horn. She ran down the stairs and jumped in beside him. "Where's Martha?" she asked, expecting her to be there. "She shot at me," Jake lied. "Those people wanted to kill us." And that was true, in a way. Had the Groats lived, they would have turned the two in. Jake's life would have been over and Greta's ruined for good. I ran away fast. "Buckle your seatbelt." "Shit," Greta shouted. She buckled her seatbelt. As they sped off by the driveway, it occurred to Jake that the police could meet them leaving. He didn't want to drive off-road, though. He floored the accelerator, hoping to reach the intersection with Route 23 before they did. "You were box up there," he heard Greta saying with a sort of warmth. Meaning like TV, I guess. They reached the end of the driveway and he jerked left onto the road, in the direction the bus came from yesterday, east. He forced himself to slow down in order to make the car look like a normal car on a trip to some normal location. To make doubly sure the police couldn't ID them, he grabbed the top of Greta's head and pushed it down, out of sight. "Hey, fuck you, asshole," Greta shouted. He tried to explain, but she was screaming. He let her up. Fortunately, they happened to miss the police, who were coming from West Milford by way of Union Valley Road. Jake and Greta were headed toward Riverdale, where he had seen some interstate exchanges. It took 30 minutes to reach Parsippany by I-247. Then they got on I-80 and sped west. Jake had no intention of returning to New York. True home was west, somewhere. Another half hour brought them close to the Pennsylvania line. Greta said indifferently, "I'm sorry, Jake," and then cried, sobbing so hard she was almost unable to catch her breath. "You thought you found a friend in that woman," he said. "It's okay. You were only talking to her. I betrayed you. I told you didn't betray me. Our host did," he added. "It's the second time a host has betrayed me, and the last." "I want my meds." "No." "Did we leave them?" she gasped. "I have them. Give them to me." "No, I'm weaning you off them." She smirked. "Come on." Jake said nothing. She stopped smirking. "I have to take them. It's my health. You'd better. I'm supposed—" Now she squealed like an animal and put her hands around his neck, digging in with her fingernails. He threw her hands off and she shoved him hard in the shoulders. The car swerved. Jake tried to straighten it out, but she grabbed the steering wheel and wouldn't let it go. They went off the right side of the three-lane highway, rolled up a shallow embankment, and turned over. The crash happened not far from a small overpass. When Jake came to, the car was upright and Greta was in her seat, looking stunned. He heard her talking in a normal-sounding voice. "Bismarck, I remember. Bismarck, North Dakota. That's where it is." Paragraph break. New scene. Chad took to the almost military routine, like a duck to water. Remember, you met the people in the restaurant, the underground. An early rise was followed by morning drills and a Spartan breakfast. The drills began with running a makeshift obstacle course and ended with target practice. In this rural area, few people paid attention to gunfire. Afternoons were spent reading combat manuals by authors unknown. "The 12-gauge," said one manual, "is unsurpassed for close-range lethality when loaded with any of the various buckshot loads. Number 4 buckshot is probably the best general-purpose load. It contains 27 projectiles of 25 caliber each and will produce a 4-foot diameter killing pattern at 40 yards. That makes this shotgun suitable for any close-to-medium-range combat situation in built-up areas. It is also reasonably accurate with rifled slugs out to about 100 yards. Rifled slugs penetrate wooden walls and barriers, car bodies and body armor, and can tear a basketball-sized hole in a living target at 50 yards. Our pre-revolutionary lives have no bearing on our mission," Josh said. Still, over 2 days, whenever they had a chance, Byron and Steve quizzed Chad about his Iran service, and he told them all about it and all about himself. Josh relaxed his harsh attitude about socializing for a moment one day, long enough to tease Steve about something. "You're practically flapping in the breeze, son," Steve replied. "Okay, Dad." Chad didn't understand what that exchange meant and ignored it. Byron went to town for supplies one day. 3 hours after he left, Steve was tasked to go and find him. Steve came back with the supplies, but alone and in Byron's car. When Chad asked what happened to Byron, Josh replied, "Reassigned." In a moment of downtime, Chad heard Josh arguing with a woman on a conference call. The argument was about money. The woman wanted Josh to move faster, and he complained that payment of some kind was 3 months late. He started off by calling her Mrs. Ackerman or Ms. Ackerman, but ended up calling her Reva. He sounded upset. She sounded unyielding. They ended the call with promises to each other. "Who is that?" Chad asked Josh. Josh's face flinched in annoyance, but he answered, "Our angel." "Angel?" Chad asked, confused. "Angel means backer," Josh explained. It wasn't long afterward that Josh had last revealed the mission for which they had been training, detailing a plan to bomb a, quote, zoo. Zoo was Kill 'Em All's, that's their group's, term for a great ape dormitory. The mainstream word was campus. Since about a year ago, large corporations housed great ape employees and their handlers. Much housing everywhere had been eminent domain, that is, seized by government, or otherwise appropriated for campuses. Sometimes housing was even raised to make room for their construction. Most of the economy participated in the scam. "Since corporations are government creatures," Josh said, "their main function, besides domestic spying, is draining the treasury. We're going to blow this fucking zoo to hell." The targeted campus lay just outside Phoenix. Steve and Chad listened closely as Josh went over the mission using a drawing of the place. "Chad will park southwest of the zoo at 1 a.m. in this business park," Josh said. He indicated a spot on the drawing. 30 minutes later, Steve and me will park by the northeast entrance. Chad leaves the bomb here." He indicated another place. "We'll wait until the target is hit, then split the trail." They did midnight drills the next 2 nights. They practiced driving with headlights off, learning how to flee invisibly in case of need. They tested burner phones. On the second night, a car's headlights came speeding to the house. It was Steve's car. The nameless driver was another young man. He gave them the required explosive material, and Josh and Steve fell to making a detonator. On the appointed day, Chad pulled his car into an industrial park on a bluff which overlooked the campus. The campus was a large warehouse-style building with only scraggly, newly planted trees to protect it. He didn't park his car where he was supposed to. They had retrieved it from the mini-mall's lot for his use in the mission. He parked the car instead at the farthest corner of the park, on purpose, because he didn't trust Josh. He had grown suspicious of Josh for hanging him out, in other words, for making him plant the bomb by himself. An operation like this normally required 2 men. One of them watched the other's back. Josh and Steve were parked on the other side of the campus and could only watch from a distance, though. Chad looked at the detonator, turning it over in his good hand. It was a radio detonator. Josh had a second, in case this one should fail. Chad slowly got out of the car and opened the trunk as carefully. The bomb sat there, heavy, but fragile. A bad move might set it off. He didn't want to lose his other leg and arm, too. He lifted it and set it down beside the car, easy. Then he camouflaged the car with old green blankets and with a brown jacket which he had grabbed before leaving HQ. His orders didn't include camouflaging, either. He carried the bomb toward the campus. The industrial park's farthest corners lacked security cameras, and he at least hoped that the campus, 500 yards away now, had no cameras to see where he would place the bomb. According to Josh, it should be placed a few feet away from the south wall so that the blast would take out the whole building. The destruction would put an end to the bunking of apes here, and it would maybe blow up some of the scumbags who came with the scheme of bunking monkeys or who accepted it. Chad didn't mind that. In fact, it was what he wanted. Still, he didn't put the bomb on the campus's south side. Instead, he circled around to the east side and put it there. The bomb sat in the open about 10 yards away from the east wall. He only had to get clear and detonate it. He paused to make sure that the bomb could be seen by Josh and Steve. He visually confirmed that there was a straight-line view to the gate where they were parked. He wiped his prints off the bomb and walked away. Running might attract somebody's attention. Strangely enough, though, the campus felt deserted. He could almost believe that he, Josh, and Steve were alone, like there were no campus personnel and no security patrol. He wondered about that. Feeling his distrust of Josh even stronger, he walked farther than necessary and stopped about 300 yards from the building. He hid behind some rocks. From this vantage, he could watch the bomb without being observed. He placed the bomb in a location different from the planned location was a test. He based his suspicion of Josh partly on fact, partly on feeling. Not only had Josh hung him out, he felt around Josh the same way he felt around the Hajis, the Arabs who joined his force in the Iran War. The supposedly friendly locals you're working with to find the jihadist. They all lied all the time. There was something about them, something shifty, unreliable. Josh was no Haji. He was a pale-skinned American, but he radiated the same shiftiness. Chad just watched the bomb. He didn't detonate it. He wanted to see if Josh would. He waited for almost an hour. Nothing happened. Did the backup detonator fail? No sooner than he thought so, he saw men approaching the bomb. They walked to it confidently. The letters on their jackets read, FBI. A couple of vehicles trailed them, bomb squad vehicles. At the head of the men was Josh. He was giving the orders. The bomb squad disarmed the bomb. The FBI agents and Josh consulted among themselves, then spread out to search the area. Chad scrambled out of there. He got back to his car by a roundabout way, pulled off the camouflage, keeping the jacket, popped off the license plate, unscrewed his old one on in its place, and drove off. Kill 'em all was a setup all along. He couldn't believe he fell for it. They wanted to frame him, or any sucker, for a terrorist act. He didn't know why and couldn't work it out. But as he sped away in the night, careering down the back roads and keeping away from the interstate, he felt impressed by their sophistication. He thought, Josh and the rest really are like Hajis, but on a higher level. He scanned the radio for news. It was too early for any news to appear about this, of course, and nothing had happened. No bomb had gone off, so likely no story would appear. But he had more than one interest in the news. And that's the end of chapter 11. Chapter 12. A storm is on the way. Chad needed a place to pull over for the night. We're on page 99 now, at the very top. 3 days had passed since he escaped Kill 'em All. Every sunset he hid somewhere, behind deserted buildings or on side roads. He didn't like being on the run, but it was part of his job now. He asked himself what his job was as he scanned the few blurry buildings that he was passing in the twilight. The temperature was dropping. To stay alive, he answered himself. He saw a sign. It was hard to read in the reduced glow from the evening sky. He stopped and put one headlight on it. The other headlight had burned out 2 nights ago. The sign said, Moe's Junkyard. He saw a dirt road near the sign. The road appeared to bend into the distance, behind a couple of fences. He followed it and came to a big pile near a shack. The pile was cars, trucks, car parts, truck beds, loose tires, and rusted hulks of different kinds. It looked like a multi-vehicle crash in the beam of his headlights. Potholes shook his car as he pulled up to the shack. He turned off the engine. It was night now. He let his eyes get used to it, and the shack's shape and details, including its door, became visible. He honked the horn, but no one came out. Should he risk it? Then he figured, what the hell? He broke in. He stumbled over a wrinkled rug. He bumped into a desk. Just enough moonlight leaked between the blinds on the sole window to assure him that no one else was here. The door and window lacked metal bars. The business was probably abandoned before GAI. He sat down in an office chair beside the desk. He felt his chin touching his chest. He was asleep. He awoke in the pre-dawn. He walked outside, stretched, and looked around. His prosthetic leg bothered him, and he adjusted it. The smallness of the junkyard caught his attention. The pile of vehicles and parts wasn't as big as it looked last night. Still, the place was okay. The road was, minimum, half a mile away. He could stay here. He looked for plumbing in the shack and found a toilet and sink in a side room about the size of a coat closet. The toilet sort of flushed. He turned the tap. Water drizzled out and kept dripping. Although the light switches flipped, the power was out. That was good. He didn't want to have a light on at night. It might attract attention. He could charge his laptop in his car. He knew the place was probably stripped. He didn't bother digging through the junk piles, big or little, for gas or other things. He had $28,000 left. If he found a grocery, he might be okay for a while. It turned out that 50 miles of driving brought him to the nearest grocery, still in business. There, he purchased a can opener and stocked up especially on canned foods, enough for about a month. Frequenter trips would be too risky. He stopped on the return and bought a headlight bulb, changing out the dead one as soon as he reached the shack. He opened the laptop every day and looked online for recent news stories about Greta Ondrakova. Far from considering himself a stalker, he knew that he was just another piece of junk in the yard. But he had to check on her because of what she still meant to him. Getting no hits, he checked in on the dissident groups. It confirmed his bitter skepticism of rebellion to see how they were doing. Kill 'em All was out of business. Counterterrorism agents shut down the group yesterday because a 15-year-old boy bombed a campus in Maine. Within hours of his arrest, Congress passed an upgrade to reparative justice. Reparative justice, or RJ, would now have teeth, Senator Markowitz informed the media and explained, humanism is terrorism. To fight it, the state must use every weapon. The upgrade? The death penalty for speech crimes. What that had to do with catching bombers wasn't explained. Chad now understood the FBI's purpose in running Kill 'Em All. It had used the boy in the same way as it had tried to use him to create an excuse for ending free speech. People for Common Sense quit. A statement appeared on their website this morning. We have said all along that we obey the government and have no problem with great ape integration. A small number of our former staff expressed unwarranted concerns about the pace of GAI's rollout. We apologize for the pain these individuals caused, and we have reported them to the appropriate authorities. We are passionate about doing the right thing. Passionate about avoiding a hot squat, Chad thought. Bible humans caved too, but they did that a week ago on their own initiative. Having grown a big following, their pastors had announced suddenly and unanimously that, quote, Christians must love all of God's creation. Monkey and Round no longer had a website. This page no longer exists, blinked the screen. Truth Tellers not only survived, it was the most popular website in history now, with tens of billions of daily viewers, according to every standard news source. It didn't matter that such high numbers were impossible. It only mattered that people believed the numbers were real. The site no longer mentioned GAI. Instead, in addition to pumping weird things such as UFOs, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the alleged benefits of mind-warping drugs and pyramids of the planet Saturn, it featured critiques of, quote, materialism, or any belief that the material world is real and that people can trust their five senses. Chad suspected that the people behind Truth Tellers were government phonies, like Kill 'Em All was. He finally saw a story about Greta. According to the story, yesterday somebody glimpsed her in North Dakota walking on Highway I-94 with an unidentified man. Whoever spotted Greta didn't have a photo to provide to the wire services, so the story showed only an anonymous homeless elder squatting near some dumpsters. The caption attacked Greta's reputation in a sneering way. Greta O has lost it this time. The lost star was seen wandering in a daze on a North Dakota highway. Maybe she is on the prowl for liquor bottles. Chad got out his gun, then he put it back. So Greta had some man with her in North Dakota. Who was he? Was he a drug dealer? A pimp? A kidnapper? A serial killer? Was he hurting or caring for her? Hurting her or caring for her? Because the weather was turning, and as far as he knew from the war, cold could kill, he tried to determine their location on a map. Scene break. The wind blew as Jake looked at the sky and tried to catch his breath. Greta wasn't less tired. A gust whipped through her clothes and she shook her head. They had been walking for just 10 minutes, but already felt a little discouraged. The air grew colder by the minute. They were just outside Tappan, North Dakota. Jake thought back to how they got here. After the car wreck, they'd walked west across Pennsylvania line to Stroudsburg, a 3-hour trek. Greta had confirmed to him that Bismarck, North Dakota meant, quote, true home, where her mother lived. In Stroudsburg, Jake had decided not to rent a car, which probably would be impossible to do anyway with cash only and no ID. Just trying it might have attracted attention. After all, the police were looking for them. So they had boarded bus 101, transferred to 102, and then transferred to a Black Stallion bus, stepping off it at the Scranton station 2.5 hours later. When he had asked her for her mother's phone number, she had said she couldn't remember it. So Jake tried calling information. He got an ape operator every time. Apes didn't speak English. They only breathed and grunted. He heard handlers in the background prompting them. Go ahead, Fernetta. Go ahead, Latrice. Good, Tamisha. Can I speak to a human, please? Jake asked and found the call disconnected. He left the phone kiosk immediately, not wanting his terroristic request to be traced to him. With no chance of her mother coming to pick them up, Jake and Greta had bought 2 one-way tickets to Bismarck. That cost $600. Greta had paid from her sock. Seeing that the trip was scheduled to last over 50 hours, how much money has she got in her sock? They decided to sleep on the bus wherever they could and to sleep in the stations during the 5 transfers. The average scheduled wait time of these transfers was 5 hours. The transfers were at Syracuse, Buffalo, Cleveland, Chicago, and Minneapolis. This trip would have brought them to Bismarck, except that Greta threw a fit when apes boarded the bus at Buffalo. She jumped off the bus as it started to move, and Jake had to follow her. Apes spooked her. There was just nothing to do about that. They blew a bunch of money. They'd gotten a partial refund and found another bus. Well, that worked. The same thing had happened at 1 of the 5 stops in Cleveland, 1 of the 6 in Chicago, and 1 of the 8 in Minneapolis. On the bus journey, they had seen the whole panoply of a dystopia. Not only the barred doors and windows on every building, but billboards of hardcore porn featuring apes and humans, rows of unlit skyscrapers at night, a dead homeless man sitting on an otherwise empty street, the very first flakes of snow landing on his nose, promotional banners with ape faces torn and blowing in the wind as if shredded by a giant claw. For hundreds of miles, an unattended dead civilization or a murdered one. Greta had whined for her meds during most of the trip till then. What if I told you I threw them all away? He asked her finally. You didn't, Jake, did you?
Yes.
What will I do now? I don't believe you're a homicidal maniac, he had said. In response, she had only shrugged. The second bus, which they had boarded in Minneapolis, had a stop in Fargo. Once there, cold and hungry, they had grabbed something to eat in the station. The food had come out of a vending machine. All the restaurants there were closed for good. These almost moldy sandwiches were the last food they ate. When they approached the bus to Bismarck, she had stopped walking and indicated the apes boarding it. Jake had frowned. There was no way she would board that bus. When they had tried to buy a ticket for another bus, they had discovered that she was out of money. Broke, they had considered walking to Bismarck, but it was 200 miles away. And winter was coming on. Jake had figured that walking would take as long as 8 days, assuming that they walked 8 hours per day and slept somewhere at night. They tried hitchhiking instead. A long-haul trucker had offered to take them. They had climbed into the cab of his truck. A pit bull terrier in a wire cage in the back of the cab barked constantly and even thrown itself repeatedly against the thin wire of the cage. When Jake had asked if they were safe, the trucker had screeched at him, "You racist assholes want to take away my baby, eh? Eh?" A volley of obscener language had followed. Jake and Greta had looked at each other, but, not wanting to have to walk, had silently decided to remain in the truck until the trucker stopped in Bismarck. The trucker, all 100 pounds of him, had eventually slumped in his seat, unconscious. Jake had grabbed the wheel and guided the truck into the right-hand margin. The trucker's foot had slipped off the accelerator and blocked access to the brake pedal. Minutes passed before the truck had come to a safe stop at last. The trucker had slumped further, and this had disturbed the oily duffel bag beside him. Pill bottles had tumbled out of the bag, all of them containing the same kind of blue-colored stimulant drug. Apparently, he had overdosed. Jake had said, "Meds kill." Ignoring the snarling pit bull, they had left the truck and continued walking. Soon seeing the Jamestown exit, they had conferred about what to do. The truck had brought them only halfway. Bismarck was still more than 100 miles distant. They had decided to keep walking until dark. On to 105. Along the way, they had tried hitchhiking again, without success. The one and only passing car they saw in 2 hours held half a dozen or so pit bulls. It had seemed crammed with them. Wondering what the deal with pits was, Jake had realized these beasts were the only thing common people could use to protect themselves from apes, and that the government must be threatening to outlaw pets or something, and probably for that very reason. They had reached Windsor, North Dakota, late at night and slept in the doorway. In the morning, before they had set off, Jake had asked her, "You're sure your mother will be there for us in Bismarck?" Greta had answered, "I hope so. There's a Welsh word, hyraeth. It means the longing and grief you feel for the lost places of the past. That is why I want to return to my true home." It's kind of like German Heimat or hyraeth, Welsh, H-I-R-A-E-T-H. That's new to me, and I don't know how you pronounce it. No one knows how to pronounce Welsh, though, really. There's probably five people. There was a long German series called Heimat. It was like an 8 or 9 part series about just, obviously they're not going to show sympathy for Nazi stuff, but just for Germany, Germanness. But I guess there's a Welsh word too. And I wonder if they're etymologically related. I don't know. Interesting. There is a Welsh word, hyraeth. It means the longing and grief you feel for the lost places of your past. That's why I want to return to my true home. They had made it as far as Medina, only a crossroads with farms. And it's probably not pronounced that way because all these like Milan, not Milan in Missouri, you know, 20, 30 miles from me, or maybe a little longer than that. They never in the Midwest are pronounced the way they are. Madrid, where the big earthquake was down in the Boot Heel, Missouri. New Madrid, not Madrid. Milan, not Milan. There's numerous others. They had made it as far as Medina, only a crossroads with farms all around it, before night fell again. They had slept under the overpass. The next day, the third day, Jake asked her what she meant by saying that he wasn't bald. He had asked this to pass the time, but she had answered seriously. "My two producers were bad people, and they were bald." She had added, "I think you're box sometimes." Box means good box office, like good luck, like money means. "You're so money, dude. Who are the crazy girls with a vampire bat?" I do remember. Maybe it's with me with a split personality. Like, you know, the bat's my evil twin. Crazy girls with a vampire bat. The bat's my evil twin. Do you have a split personality? I do, if both are cold and hungry. Or if I do, both are cold and hungry, she had said. "What did you mean," he asked, "when you said my nose was eaten?" I'll tell you that later. Darkness had fallen again and put them under another overpass for the night, but not before they'd gone into a gas station convenience store to warm up. They hadn't begged. They had gone out as hungry as they came in. Jake now thought of all that, surveying their whole 1,600-mile journey, including 50 miles of walking, with at least 50 more to go. They were on the verge of merely stumbling along. They had left the overpass in the morning light 20 minutes ago, maybe 40 minutes. The wind rose again. Jake felt his legs getting numb. For the first time in days, a car came out of the distance. It slowed, turned, and bumped through the grassy medium. It stopped just across from them. The driver rolled his window down. A young man with a growth of beard, he called to them, "It's too cold to be walking. Don't you know a storm is on the way?" Jake and Greta stopped walking but said nothing. The man got out of his car. He was disabled. An obvious prosthetic arm and leg gave a swinging gait to his approach. He shook Jake's hand. Chad Bingham. Jake McAllister. And that's where it and we end, at the end of chapter 12. All of our three main heroes meet, page 106, a little more than halfway through the novel. Chad and Greta meet Jake McAllister, or Jake and Greta meet Chad. So quite exciting, and there are all kinds of stumbles and craziness going on in the country. We'll see what happens next. Anyway, I've been Alex Linder, reading to you out of The Eradicator by Mike Smith. Exciting 2024 novel. He's got a Substack, and you can find everything permanently archived as part of our Learning College that we do at vnnforum.com. So thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again for more from The Eradicator real soon.